Half of them, I think, showed some what we call thigmotaxis, which is that it tends to fire a little bit more on the periphery, like that.
What was the animal doing during this
Just
recovery?
foraging for food pellets again.
And in a uniformly
Well,
formatted
that's
way?
a good question. Again, I'd have to go back and look at the data. I'm trying to, the animals, I'm trying to remember the extent to which the animals tended to hug the sides.
Did you turn off the lights? Is this with the lights on?
No, with the lights on.
Oh.
So yeah, the
What
animals
about
are.
if you turn them off when you're changing?
I don't think if you turn them off, that would change things. I mean, rats are not as visually dependent as we are, as primates are. I'll look that up for you. I mean, for this, but you know, but I mean, you just have to take my word that people who study place cells, I mean, generally we do not. Usually, we don't call this a place field. It's just not constant. It's not dense enough like you see over here. You know.
I mean, somehow that's enough. You get many units that have that kind of specificity, you could construct a pretty good predictor of where the animal is. And so, therefore, you know where. I agree, maybe it's not the same as 4 hours, but it's kind of
Yeah.
pretty interesting.
Well,
It seems actually kind of interesting. I mean, there's an important clue, right?
I'll show you another one that I have in here, though it's not
Other
as.
worlds, it's a
Yeah.
chemical world.
Well, let me show you another one. That one I showed you is more typical.
Seems like a finding, not
Hold on. Here's another one. This one you're going to say is a little bit more placey. So here's 1 hour. It's still there. Here's four. Here's 12. I mean, it does seem to retain some placiness, but even better than the last one I showed you. But it's well, there's a number of different ways that we measure how, quote, placey or how location-specific firing is a particular cell. And the values certainly go down for this example. But again, when it recovers, I mean, it recovers exactly in the same place in this example
So
here.
you're injecting TTX and you're just letting it wash out of the animal?
Yeah. And it takes about 48 hours for it to actually recover.
How much physiologically to recover?
Yeah. But I mean, certainly, yeah, 12 hours, I'd say, you know, there's some resemblance of a place there. I mean, here's almost really a second place field. You know, 24 and 36, it's, yeah, there's probably some more concentration down there, but I mean, you can obviously tell the difference between, you know, a map like this and this one, you know, and again, versus the six when it's fully recovered.
It's probably not just using stimulation prevention for place
No, I mean, and actually, to be honest, I mean, we did not anticipate this result. I mean, I really anticipated the cells should still be there. But it just seems to be very strongly affected by it. Yeah. You still have all the what? The landmarks?
The landmarks are not
Yeah.
visual cues.
Yeah. All the visual cues are certainly still present. And so I was not even, you know, predicting that a vestibular lesion would knock out head direction cells. I mean, my grant had all these experiments that we were going to do on the head direction cells in vestibular lesioned animals. And I did not at all anticipate that the signal was going to go away. So it just ended all those proposed experiments we were going to do. But I mean that was the result. Okay.
So can I just interrupt? I mean,
yeah.
If you interrupt the vestibular system and then you put an animal in a novel environment, it's more immune for itself. You just kind of restrict on that little sense from puppy animal and loop during vestibular lesion. You get new place stuff.
You mean you popped it in the new environment while under the influence of the vestibular lesion?
Yeah. I mean, it shows things form within a half hour, which is all.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you would get location specific firing while the animal's under the influence of the vestibular lesion. When it comes back, you probably would get remapping. So the place fields would all be scrambled around when you put it back in the new environment again. But the animal may not have, I mean, never really established a firing pattern per se in the novel environment to begin with, under the influence of the vestibular lesion. What?
Okay.
Well, I'm trying. Bruce had a poster, also where they did a vestibular manipulation with the animals at this year's neuroscience meeting, and they got a disruption too of the place fields, I believe. So I think it's real. Yeah. I mean, it's not like we're losing the cell. It's still the same cell, and it certainly has a profound effect on it. Okay, so getting back to how the vestibular system might be connected up with parts of the limbic circuitry, where you find the head direction cells and place cells. So if the head direction cell signal generation is dependent upon vestibular input, then how is this signal conveyed to the head direction cell circuitry? And the traditional view, if you go back through the literature, is that the vestibular nuclei here has direct projections to ventral posterior thalamus, which is sort of the somatosensory of the thalamus, which then projects up to somatosensory cortex. And then an area within the parietal cortex that's called the parietal insular vestibular cortex. And then this area is thought to project down into the limbic system and hippocampus that way. That's the traditional view. But if you go into the literature, you can identify anatomically an alternative pathway where there is a major projection from the medial vestibular nucleus, which just by coincidence is the nucleus that receives a very large component from the horizontal semicircular canal. So the three semicircular canals oriented in different dimensions, the horizontal, the medial vestibular nucleus receives its bulk, not all, but certainly the bulk of information from the horizontal semicircular canal, which again is telling you about angular acceleration in the horizontal plane, exactly what you would want for head direction cells. In any case, the medial vestibular nucleus sends a very huge projection to the nucleus prepositus, which has been hypothesized to be where the neural integrator is for the ocular motor circuits. And then the nucleus prepositus projects to an area referred to as the dorsal tegmental nucleus, which then in turn projects to the lateral mammillary nuclei. Okay? And this pathway actually from the dorsal tegmental nucleus to the lateral mammillary nuclei is actually GABAergic and is therefore thought to be inhibitory. Okay? So this is an inhibitory pathway. There's also a reciprocal projection, which is thought to be excitatory going back from the lateral mammillary nuclei to the dorsal tegmental nucleus. And then this pathway here is sort of a minor pathway. It's there in the literature, but the authors didn't think it was of primary importance. The major pathway really is going like this and up. So that sort of asks or begs the question, what types of information is encoded here in the dorsal tegmental nucleus? Okay, and it turns out that within the dorsal tegmental nucleus, about 75% of the cells have firing rates correlated to the animal's angular head velocity. And two different types of angular head velocity correlates were found. And one is shown here, and these are dorsal tegmental nucleus symmetric angular head velocity cells. And here we're plotting the firing rate of the cell here as a function of the animal's angular head velocity. And we call these symmetric because whether the animal is turning clockwise or counterclockwise, the higher the velocity that the head is turning, the higher the firing rate of the cell. Here's another example of one over here, slightly higher firing rate. But again, it's symmetric in both in terms of clockwise and counterclockwise directions. Firing rate goes up the faster the animal is turning its head. And this is real. That we saw several cells where basically you have a sort of two linear functions, or that the total function is really best described as two composed of two sublinear functions. Whereas this one here is obviously more or less just one. The other category, so this is the symmetric cells, and here is the other category, which was about a third of the cells. The symmetric ones were about two-thirds of the cells. This category is an asymmetric category, where you can see the firing rate only increases above the sort of tonic firing rate with no head turns, only in one direction. So, well.
I mean, for people, it's symmetric for small speed.
That's true, and I purposely put that in here to show you some differences, so you can see the difference. I mean, this one you might say there might be a slight dip there. This one certainly has a very pronounced dip, and that's at very, very slow angular head velocities. But I mean, overall, you know, you have this asymmetricness here, as well as on this side. So that's why we group these together. What?
It's very funky.
Very funky? Yeah, I mean, this over here, I mean, it's not even being modulated within the counterclockwise direction. Whereas on this one, you know, it is being modulated in sort of the other one.
But is this a general truth that if you look very close to zero speed, very close, you get symmetry? You've got these dips?
These dips? Well, in some cells, we'll show that. Yeah, that's real. I mean, the last one. Oops. Yeah, I mean, again, right around zero, this one again shows it. This one doesn't show it. So some show it, some don't.
I mean, it's still symmetric. I mean, these are symmetric around zero. I mean, all cells have a little symmetry around zero.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It just changes the way you think about the system.
Yeah. I don't have any more pictures to show you, but I mean, some of them are symmetric around zero like this, and other ones, I mean,
that has a little symmetry around zero.
Yeah. I mean, like, right, just for a couple of data points.
Yeah, for a feedback circuit.
Yeah.
You could still use it stable.
Yeah.
What tells me is that the highest rate should have the lowest error bars, naively, but there's too much scatter.
Yeah, there's a lot of scatter at the ends because the number of samples is at these very high angular head velocities is a lot less. I mean, just think, for every time the animal is going to turn its head real fast, you got to go through.
This
isn't a behaving animal, yeah. Every time the animal turns its head real fast, it's got to go through all the lower head lower angular head velocities. So consequently, the total number of samples at the lower angular head velocities are going to be much greater than at the high end. Oh, spin the animal?
Discharge.
Discharge.
Well,
we have a commutator so that it's in theory doesn't get tangled up. But, I mean, we were trying to first do this in freely moving animals, yeah. If you anesthetize the animal, the head direction cells go away. I don't know about these. We haven't tried these. And I don't know what they do in sleep.
Yeah.
We haven't looked at that either.
You never said what to do with the absolute one.
I know, and we're getting to that. All right, so in this alternative view for how vestibular information might get up to the lateral mammary nuclei here, I mean, here's the dorsal tegmental nucleus with angular head velocity cells here in blue. The nucleus preposterous is loaded with angular head velocity cells, and of course, that's what the medial vestibular nucleus is all about, is angular head velocity. So you've got all this angular head velocity information here that's being funneled up, basically, to the lateral mammary nuclei. Now, so I don't have to tell this audience that, but certainly, the integral of velocity with respect to time, of course, is angular position. So starting from a known directional heading, a mathematical integration time of angular head velocity will give you angular head displacement. So perhaps a neural integrator similar to the one that's involved in the vestibular ocular reflex is present in the DTN, dorsal tegmental nucleus to lateral mammary nuclei pathway. I mean, that's a hypothesis. I mean, but you can start from there. Well, that's right. The first integration goes on between the semicircular canals and the medial vestibular nucleus. So the semicircular canals are sensitive to angular acceleration. The cells here are just like the primary eighth nerve fiber, which is sensitive to angular head velocity. So they actually, the ocular motor and vestibular people call the sort of the fact that you see a velocity, angular head velocity signal that outlasts the stimulus, they call that the velocity storage mechanism. And this would be another example where the angular head velocity signal certainly is being propagated through the network. And although I haven't really showed you that it outlasted the actual stimulus itself, but it means that given the time constant of which the fluids within the canal are supposedly coming back to their initial state, the signal outlasts what the signal from the canals are telling you. So in other words, if the canal signal is over at time 1 second later, the signal in the system outlasts the 1 second. It's still there at maybe 3 or 4 seconds later. So they call that the velocity storage mechanism because the
it's integration. You say if there is an acceleration, which
yeah.
stops up at some moment, the cells integrate in it, so they keep
the velocity signal stays around, is present for a longer time period than it should be.
So they are not yeah.
Well, they are. They are encoding the velocity at which you had just previously turned your head, but they're present longer than they should be. Given that, in other words, the signal outlasts the sensory stimulus. It's like you flash light and then you flash it off. The signal should be gone, but in this system, the presence of the visual perception would still be there. Would outlast the sensory stimulus. That's what those people. I mean, I'm not a vestibular ocular motor. Well, there might be some cells that are encoding current, and there might be some cells that are encoding
in the past.
In the past. Yeah. Yeah. So that the signal is being reverberated through the circuit somehow. Yeah. So. If you look at the primary eighth nerve, which is the nerve that conveys the signal from the vestibular labyrinth to the vestibular nucleus, the signal in the eighth nerve, the cranial nerve, is encoding angular head velocity. Angular head velocity. So the signal has already been integrated once, going from the canals themselves to the eighth nerve. Some of it is wrapped up, I think, in what they call the cupular mechanics, the mechanics of the fluid flowing within the semicircular canals. I mean, yeah. Well, here there's no integration at all going on here. It's just the velocity signal being propagated. Yeah. Oh, well, the integration would be occurring someplace, yes, like right here.
No, but before that, you said maybe this is
the... Well, there's an integration. All right, so there's one integration going on from here.
The second one is from the TM2 element.
That's right. Yeah.
So when what happens in nuclear propulsion?
Nothing. Well, no, I'm sure it's not nothing, but I...
Well, then you have the asymmetric. Because I see the earthquakes from people that... So I know all the nuclear propulsions which are in the direction.
Well, the nucleus prepositus, if you look up it in the literature, this is where the ocular motor people place the integrator for the vestibular ocular reflex. Okay?
This is what we said before.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So.
So there are clockwise cells and counterclockwise cells in the vestibular pre. In the hair cells?
There are what?
From the actual hairs and semicircular canals, how do they tell clockwise or counterclockwise?
They have the hair cells look like this, and there's a tall one and there's a short one, and they're all sort of lined up like this. And depending upon whether, well, they get excited if they are bent going towards the tall one, and they get inhibited or the fire rate goes down if they get bent the other way.
So there's a linear one that's going through zero. So at zero they're firing say 70 hertz.
That's right. So at zero with them straight up like that, they're firing at 70 hertz.
And if they go in counterclockwise, they fire lower, clockwise they fire higher.
Yeah. Right.
So then if you can use propositus, you get those symmetric cells came out of that somehow.
Yeah, well, all the cells I showed you were from the dorsal tegmental nucleus.
Sorry, dorsal nucleus.
Yeah.
So that was one calculation, right? The change, the symmetrized clockwise
current. I'm not sure. There was one change?
Because you showed absolute value of
velocity
cell and directional.
Right.
Now, does that exist also in the hair cells?
Oh, yes. Well, the hair cells on one side might look, be oriented like this, and the hair cells in your other ear might be oriented just the opposite. Yeah. So you have sort of like a push-pull thing. When one side's being excited, the other side's being inhibited. Okay.
Can I ask an incredibly stupid question?
Yeah.
The vestibular system tells you about rotation. You get a signal during beta dot. But what tells you about translation?
What tells you about what?
What's measuring translation? If I rotate my head,
if
what's going on?
Okay. So. Okay. Okay. So you have three canals. This is the lateral post, so, and they all are oriented in three different planes. So one of them is particularly suited for this, telling you about angular acceleration and pitch.
No, I didn't mean that. Okay.
Yeah.
I that gives you three angles, but what tells you that you're moving forward?
Oh, linearly?
Yeah.
That's the otolith organs. That's the utricle and the saccule.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. And it'll also tell you the direction of gravity. So it basically just tells you linear acceleration, either forwards, backwards, up or down, or even side to side. Like this.
No, I tried to understand the place cell. So you've lost all of this when you walk through the vestibular organ.
That's right. Yeah. So when we inject, is the ear canal even in here? I mean, the ear canals. I don't see the, but I mean, you're blocking all the whole thing by injecting either the neurotoxin or TTX in there. What we're actually doing now is there is a surgical technique we're collaborating with a group at Hopkins where you go in and you plug. The way these canals work is that there's a little bit of fluid in there, okay? And when you turn the bone, this is bone, okay? And when you turn your head, the fluid tends to stay in the same place. You know, it's like me turning this glass here with water in it. You turn this, the hard structure turns, but the fluid stays still. And across the structure in the canal, there's something that's called a cupula, it's a membrane. And so when you turn your head and the bone starts spinning, of course the membrane goes with it, but the fluid tends to stay in the same place. So this cupula, this membrane, gets bent in one particular direction as it pushes against the fluid. So you can disrupt that by plugging the canals, so to prevent the fluid from shifting. So we're trying to do that now, which is a much more selective way of lesioning these things and seeing their effects. It's not as drastic. Okay. Okay. Here's something that's a little bit more challenging, and it's sort of up your guys' alleys. It has a little bit to do with modeling. So here's this overall circuit here, where again we have the dorsal tegmental nucleus down here, and the medial vestibular nucleus projecting up like that with the neural integrator. Okay, and as I said, this is thought to be an inhibitory signal, as well as this. The nucleus preposus is also thought to be inhibitory. Now, people, and when I say people, I mean Skaggs and McNaughton, Blair and Sharp, Reddish, Goodrich, Turetsky, and Ketch and Zhang, they've all sort of proposed sort of continuous attractors, where these are like these ring attractors, to explain head direction self-firing. And in these attractor networks, you have one set of cells, like say up here, that happen to be on, that might have some recurrent excitation, which keep the neighboring cells representing neighboring head directions also on, whereas they would be inhibiting cells that are 180 degrees opposite. You also, these models also have visual inputs which can come in and influence the cells, as well as vestibular or motor units to help basically turn the bump within the attractor network. Now, here are some thoughts to ponder. And assume that the head direction self-firing arises from a continuous attractor network. And then if you remove the inputs to the attractor network, so if I go back here, and you remove these inputs by maybe say removing either the visual inputs or removing these inputs, modelers like yourselves sort of tell me that either you would expect the hill, if you remove the inputs into the attractor network, either you might leave the hill of activity stationary so that the bump stays locked in one position. And in that case, a subset of head direction cells from your population should be continuously active. Okay. Or the hill of activity might become unstable and you might start drifting that hill of activity around the ring. Okay. And in this condition, if you're expecting the hill to basically drift continuously around the wing, you might expect to see some cells that have bursts of activity as the hill of activity happens to pass through that cell's preferred firing direction.
Would just die out? Yeah,
why not?
There's also a media where they all fire.
I would say you did a good job, because these are the non-trivial predictions.
These are the non-trivial.
Right, and the theorists are just kind of voicing the things that will save their skin.
It's the most likely because it's getting massive inhibition, and when you shut that off, it tend to go
calm. In the short run, maybe.
Let's see what. Okay, tell us.
All right, well, Okay, so our findings from vestibular, okay, with the lesions of 11 cells that we've recorded, and remember these cells have 90 degree tuning, so it's like one out of every four cells should be sort of at least on somewhat. Okay, none of them were tonically on. I mean, all 11 cells, when you did the vestibular lesion, went off. Okay, what?
C.
Well, okay, you're right. I mean, you might be right. I mean, the other thing is none of the 11 cells showed any bursty activity. Now, there were cells that were bursty, that did show bursty activity, but they weren't the head direction cells. And if you, here's what a normal head direction cell looks like. If you plot, again, head direction versus firing rate across time in 1 minute epochs, and this, so time is on this sort of z-axis going back this way, over 16 minutes. And you can see that basically you have, you know, all these head direction cell tuning curves all line up. Here over here is a bursty cell where it's bursting, but you can see it's bursting at all different head directions. Right? Now, in the vestibular lesion animals, none of these cells turned into this. All of these bursty cells were only seen when we... After we recorded for 4 days or whatever, and we didn't see any more head directions, I mean, the head direction cell was lost, then we started turning the electrodes, looking for other head direction cells. And we didn't see any, but we then started seeing this type of activity. We never saw this type of activity in a non-lesioned animal. So we only saw these bursty cells only in a lesioned animal, but they weren't the head direction cells.
So.
Well,
this is what? No, this is ADN. And anterior thalamus.
Cells can fire with redox, right? It could be inhibitory cells. Inhibition could actually cause it to fire with redox. So when you shut it off, you can turn it off.
Yeah, I mean, not in a non-lesion animal, I'd say about close to half of the cells in the ADN are head direction cells. Which is typically why, if we go looking for the cells and we're trying to do various manipulations, we usually look in the anterior thalamus. But the other 50% are doing something else, and this one here is coming from that other 50%.
Can we perfuse stuff in? I'm just trying to answer your. Yeah. It's a series of kind of check a model, right? And as you say, it does nothing. It's a failure. You turn it off, then there's no strong prediction from this attractor model. I mean, someone tries to
talk. Well, then you can say it's not. So, what all of those models assume is that this is a persistently held bump, meaning that you get a little impulse of activity that toggles up and self-sustains.
That's right.
But then now that I'm hearing from you is that it's getting constant input all the time, so it doesn't have to be a self-sustaining. It could just be more like visual orientation or shaping into some sort of bump. And then just a strong, the inhibition of just shutting down the outside. And then if you turn off the input, you would predict it would just go off. That's a prediction. That's not saying nothing.
Well, it's but many things.
It's saying that the persistent activity doesn't exist in the ATM. It's not a self.
That's
sort of been on the books to try to infuse in some GABA agonists or antagonists and see what happens. I was talking with Ketchin Zhang the other day at the meetings, and he said you increase inhibition by 5%, you just might knock out the whole bump. That's what his model sort of...
He's speaking in terms of current expectation, and these networks don't have that. This has got recurrent inhibition, right? There's no recurrent expectation in the
mouth. There's no evidence for it.
So the intuition is actually reversed. Inhibition is excited for it.
I see.
I think that's a very big one. Yeah. Because there is a
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
What? You want to go back to the circuit?
Yeah.
Oops. Well, hold on. Yeah, it's good enough.
In the past speaker, it's a very complex thing. You know, expect, any simple answer would be kind of, would not be the product of.
Well, let me say that the internal anatomy is pretty, is well worked out for hippocampus, somewhat for spiculum, but the internal anatomy for these structures is not very well known. So the extent to which there's either recurrent excitation or recurrent inhibition, there's just really no evidence. No one knows. I think that's, it'd be really nice if some anatomist did some work there. But anyways, I show you this because I thought you'd be interested in it. I usually think of the attractor networks as saying either the bump should be sustained or it should drift around.
That's a Carson.
Yeah.
You're right. At the extreme case of feedback. Right.
I see. So if you take away the input, you want the bump to go away.
Right. The feedback is just at the shape, right?
I see, yeah. Okay. What? Oh. Oh.
Well, if you do a partial block, you get a broadening of the bump.
I know. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
there's
this inhibition of something
when
a man. Is there any
clue of
what?
What is the function of the inhibition? I don't know. I should mention this. There's some evidence that it uses acetylcholine. There's also evidence that it uses GABA. So I drew this in as a GABA, but it could also be excitatory. No one knows. There's no evidence one way or the other on that. Yeah.
Talking about the HB, you said there are some cells that do outlast.
Not so much within here. Whether it's this one, I don't know. We haven't done the appropriate experiments for that. Yeah. No, because the head direction, you turn the head, the signal follows it. So you don't have a quote storage mechanism with head direction that you do with the velocity.
Which was the area again that showed the very wide tune curve?
This one. They're not all wide, but they tend to be wider there.
So is there a way to titrate into the dorsal tegmental nucleus and see if you titrate in a gamma blocker, they also start to get broader?
They also start to get what?
If they start to broaden.
Oh, broaden?
That as the raw tuning curve and then the interactions.
It's a hard experiment to do, but it's certainly doable. I mean, no one's done that. You want to titrate GABA in or out?
Well,
you want an agonist or an antagonist?
If you take this view, okay, the interactions are always shaping the tuning curve. Then you can maybe just say for fun that's the bare width of the tuning curve, right? And then you have one interactions that are narrowing.
It's all rate divided.
Yeah.
So then you like titrate away those interactions and see if you recover the spare two units.
So if you titrate away the interactions, I mean, so if you put a GABA blocker in, I mean, you might expect it to. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, would you expect it to to get narrow?
Well, if inhibition, because the rebound is actually like excitation, then you would expect it to get narrow.
Narrow, okay.
But when you add GABA blocker, it should get faster. There would be a prediction from all these models.
If you had a GABA blocker in, you would get a wider
range. Right, so to match the width of
the fat guys. Okay.
No, I mean, it's nice. It's like you're taking this seriously.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, I think it's the only really model that's really been proposed outside of some stuff that Carson's been doing with John Rubin a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I'm not an anti-attractor person, but I'm not quite sure if all the data is there for to show that attractor, you know. So I don't think we should assume that that's how it works and that's it. You know?
So, are there any other ideas
around? Well, Carson and John Rubin had this other sort of rebound excitation. I mean, you should explain it, not me.
Well, we were thinking in terms of persistent stadium and rebound. And then what you need fast GABA A sustains it, makes GABA B shut it down. That's an attractor, but we never thought of it in terms of feed forward. But one of the problems that we couldn't get.
But it also explains the integration.
No, we were just trying to sustain it because it's almost. Everyone is, well, we assume suppose DAL ATN is like a reciprocal, so then there's no recurrent expectation. So then all these other models.
Okay,
so
they just have to make adaptive without the same.
Exactly.
But still, the same idea, just in terms of.
But then you don't get the nice peak thing for the flat. So the question now is how do you get a peak thing for the
All right. Can we move on from attractors? Are we ready? Okay. All right. Two other parts here. One was I want to talk a little bit about navigation, and then I'm going to talk about the 3D stuff. When behavioralists talk about navigation, usually we talk about two systems, and we've already talked a little bit about this already, but we make a distinction between a landmark system where you're taking a positional fix, and in this case you're using familiar salient external cues in the environment such as landmarks, and you tend to use them episodically. Okay, it's not like you've got to stare at the door to keep yourself oriented. You just look at the door occasionally as the landmark. Okay, and examples of that would be stuff in the visual or items in the visual, auditory, or olfactory, or even somatosensory realms. Okay. In contrast, there's this internal navigation system which uses more path integration, where you're using internal, what's known as idiothetic cues that are resulting from the animal's own movements. And here, rather than using it episodically, you're using them, these cues, continuously. And examples here, vestibular proprioceptive, kinesthetic cues, motor reference copy, or even for that matter, optic or auditory flow. Although optic and auditory flow is really external information, but you are using it continuously as opposed to episodically.
What's the difference between proprioception and kinesthetic?
Not much. Some people like think of a kinesthesis, so I put both of them up there so people understand better. All right. Now we get back to those experiments where I had the animal either in a cylinder or in the rectangle over here. And you remember, if you had the animal in a cylinder and then you put it in the rectangle, you often got a shift in the cell's preferred firing direction. So usually the rat is placed into arenas that are different, usually get shifts greater than 50 degrees most of the time. So you could ask, what happens when the rat walks in from the cylinder into the rectangle? okay, rather than picking the animal up and putting it in. Okay, now if you allow the animal to walk in this situation, what happens? And so, if it turns out that if you allow the rat, so here, if the cell is pointing this direction here, and you allow the rat to walk in, generally you don't get a shift in the cell's preferred firing direction. It usually remains within plus or minus 18 degrees of what it was in the cylinder. So allowing the animal to make its own movements now into the alternative, or what is a novel environment, will keep the cell basically in the same preferred firing direction. Okay. And actually, this is, yeah. So that's, yeah, so here, you know, you start with the door closed, and then you open up the door and you let the rat walk in. Okay, and then you can let the rat walk back into the same thing. And here's some data. Here's from a standard session while the rat's in the cylinder. And then here's the session in the novel when the rat's walked over into the rectangle. You can see here in the red now, there's a slight, you know, maybe what, a 12 degree shift or so in the cell's preferred firing direction. It, again, we're still throwing food pellets. The rats will naturally explore. So when you open up the door right here. Yeah, we shut the door. Yeah, to going back, yeah. So if you allow the animal to walk back and forth, you'll generally find that the cells pretty much, the preferred firing directions will overlap. Now, you might ask, what is the influence of motor efferent copy cues or optic flow in updating the cell's preferred firing direction when the animal goes in to the novel environment? And so for that, we ran an experiment where we did two manipulations. Either we had the room lights on or off, okay? So if the room lights are on, you have optic flow. You turn off the room lights, of course, there's no optic flow. And we also, sometimes, we either let the animal walk in under its own volition or power, or we put it on a little wheel, on a little cart, and we just wheeled the rat in on the cart, okay? So when we wheel the rat in on the cart, of course you're going to be depriving the animal of the normal motor efferent copy cues that it uses to get into this new environment. And you can set up a little 2x2 matrix where we're either, you know, having the animal on the wheeled cart or the room lights are on or off, and we're manipulating basically optic flow or the motor efferent copy. And you can set up, here's the 2x2 matrix with either the rat walks in under its own volition or it's passively transported on the cart, or you have the room lights on or the room lights off. Okay, so with the room lights on and the rat walks in, of course, all cues are available and the preferred firing direction is generally maintained. That was the data that I just showed you. Okay, so if that rat walks in with the room lights on, everything is pretty much okay. Turn the room lights off, of course, you're only disrupting optic flow, but you still have intact motor efferent copy and intact vestibular cues. You now start transporting the animal either with the room lights on, so you normally have intact optic flow and intact vestibular cues, but now you're only going to be disrupting motor efferent copy, or you can passively transport the animal in with the room lights off, in which case you're disrupting both motor efferent copy and optic flow, but you still have intact vestibular cues. So what happens? Okay. Turns out that if you passively transport the animal in on the cart, you will get a substantial shift, as you see here, in the cell's preferred firing direction. So here's normal in the standard cylinder, and here's what it is in the rectangle after you transported the animal in on the little cart. Okay. And if you looked at all the data, here's the 2x2 table again. Remember I said that the average shift when the animal walks in under its own volition is about plus or minus 18 degrees in the preferred firing direction. But if the animal is transported on the cart, the average shift now is about plus or minus 65, whether the room lights are on or off, it doesn't really matter. When the room lights are just off and the animal goes under its own volition, you get a slight increase in the shift of the preferred firing direction. But certainly the motor efferent copy cues seem to be very important for the cells to sustain the same preferred firing direction as the animal moves into a new environment. So what do we know? This sort of sums it up a little bit in terms of that head direction cells are certainly multimodal, and the vestibular system seems to be very important for generating the signal, but the motor efferent copy cues, as evidenced by the transport on the wheel cart, seem to be important for updating the directional signal. So I took a lot of the lines off, but basically, I mean, we've sort of thought that here's your sort of, you were wondering where's the input into the system. So here's the visual cortex up here. I mean, we generally think that visual landmark information is coming down from the visual cortex into parietal, into posterior cingulate, and sort of converges here in the anterior thalamus, as we have idiothetic information coming from the vestibular nuclei up. Well, the optic flow would be coming probably from up here too. Yeah. So the optic flow would be coming from up here. How motor information gets in is a little bit less clear. I mean, it might be coming directly from motor cortex like this, or it could be coming from the striatum up through this pathway. There's this pathway here from the medial through the medial mammillary nuclei that goes up to the anterior thalamus. But in any case, I mean, it's sort of like, it's around this area that I think this information, this motor and visual information, sort of converges. Now, I mean, there is some convergence here as well, because the postsubiculum does feed back into here, too. But, yeah. Yes, I did talk about that. Sid Wiener and Sherry Mizumori have both shown their head direction cells here. That's the only place that head direction cells have been shown that aren't within this little part of the circuit.
It's a lot or a little?
A lot? I don't know what the percentage is. It's not over 10% of the cells. It's a low percentage. From here to the striatum, only through some long loop pathways. Nothing real prominent that's direct. I think it's universally. Our lab has never tried to record here, but both Sherry Mizumori and Sid Wiener, two independent labs, have now shown that they are there. So I believe this more than I do this one.
And it's the same stick. It's not that narrow. They have sharp sides.
The Sid Wiener study only showed three cells, and they didn't plot them with real fine grain 6-degree analysis. So it's hard. I think his bins were, what were they? There may be 22.5-degree bin sizes. I mean, they looked about the same. And Sherry Mizumori's papers, she also looks at it in a radial arm maze, and she doesn't plot out sort of the tuning curves that we have done. So it's hard to say exactly how similar they are, but by all, a first perusal, I would say that they look pretty similar. But they haven't been studied as extensively. Here to here? It's possible, yeah. Okay. 3D. Animals, I mean, we live sort of two-dimensionally, although we do live in apartment buildings that go up and down, but certainly rodents live in a much more three-dimensional world. So we wanted to know... What?
It's kind of, I don't know, somewhere between 1 and 2.
Oh. Yeah. Well, anyways. So how do head direction cells fire in terms of three dimensions? Now we know that they fire certainly within the as a function of how the head is in the horizontal plane, but what happens in the vertical plane? Okay, And another very important question is how do the cells define what the horizontal reference frame is? And this becomes very important for people who work with NASA when the astronauts go up and they're in zero G in all sorts of, you know, unfamiliar orientations. How you begin to define what the floor versus the ceiling is in your orientation becomes very important, particularly to avoid getting sick up in space. A good percentage of the astronauts are often very, very, they have what they call space motion sickness during the first day or two that they're up in space. And it's very comparable or analogous to, you know, motion sickness on the ground, like seasickness or car sickness, something like that. But that's a whole nother story. We can get into that. To try to just look at what head direction cells do when the animals are in a vertical plane, we constructed sort of this apparatus where we have a cylinder again, although it's a little bit higher than the one that you saw on the video. And we put a sort of wire mesh ladder along the wall. And you could actually rotate this mesh ladder around to the different places within the cylinder. And the rat could just basically climb up the mesh ladder to this sort of annulus that's up here where there are food cups. And then it would run around collecting the food from the food cups up on top. So an example of a typical recording protocol is we would record the cell on the floor here and then let the animal climb up the mesh in each of these different configurations. And we define the mesh 0 degree position as corresponding to the direction of which the head direction cell likes to fire. So because the head direction cell is firing going down here, we call this the mesh 0 degree position, and then 180 degrees opposite is the mesh 180 degrees, and then you have the mesh 90 and 270, okay, which are these two side positions. Here's the rat going up. Here's the rat up on top. Here's a picture of the rat going down.
it's funded by the Navy. You know, they have those mesh on the side.
Oh, yeah. So what do the cells do? Well, first of all, interestingly, and we were a little bit surprised at this, you know, remember I told you it's very hard to get the peak firing rate of the cell to be modulated. And in this particular case is an example of where the peak firing rate is modulated a little bit. We did this, we have 13 cells where we record the animal first on the floor and then up here on the top of the annulus. And in 12 out of the 13 cells, there was a higher firing rate when the animal was up here on top than it was on the bottom. And here's one example. So it has the same preferred firing direction up on top as it does on the bottom, but you can see that the peak firing rate is larger. Now, not all cells had this 2-to-1 ratio, but 12 out of 13, like I said, did increase the rate when the animal was up high. Now, what that's attributed to, I don't know. I mean, it might just be because the animal's got to pay a little bit more attention there so it doesn't fall off is one possibility. Or it could somehow be encoding something to do with height. I don't know. Now, what did the cells do on the vertical wall? Well, here's a cell that fired, at about, 7:30 or so. And so here's the mesh 0 degree position. And you can see this particular cell fired when the animal went up the mesh, but it didn't fire when the animal went down the mesh, the blue line. Okay? So that means when the animal approaches the mesh in the direction that the cell likes to fire, the cell will stay on as the animal climbs up the mesh.
I'm not confused. How do you find heading relative to the plane of the animal or relative to the horizontal?
Well, here... All right, so, I mean, up with, well.
So the animal's on the floor.
When the animal's on
the floor. Going straight down, there's no such thing as heading direction anymore.
Well, but now we're defining, the horizontal plane is this vertical surface, the vertical surface of the mesh.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, the best way to think of this, imagine you've got a cell that fires this direction here. Okay, so the cell's on as the rat approaches the wall. The animal goes up this wall over here. The cell stays on the entire time the animal climbs up the vertical mesh. If it turns its... Let me just stop there. So going up the wall, it stays on the entire time. The animal gets up to the top, it turns around up there. It's now facing the opposite direction, so the cell shuts off. And it remains off as the animal comes down the mesh here. Well, if it rotates, if it turns its head while it, so if the cell's on as the animal's going up, and then it turns its head over this way or over this way while it's going up, the cell will shut off. So typically the animal goes up, it's firing as it goes up, and then it'll usually go around, it will collect the food out of these pellets, and when it's facing 730 up on top of the annulus, which is what I showed you in the last slide. It will continue to fire. So, darn it. Yeah. So it will. So here, the red dashes are when it's up on the annulus, and the black is when it's on the cylinder floor. So it's firing the same direction, up on the annulus as it is on the floor. All right. But now when it goes down, see. When it's up there and it's going to go down, the cell fires. When the mesh is at the 180 degree position. So before the mesh was over here, now the mesh is over there. So if this is the direction that the cell likes to fire, in other words, so the cell is off, now the animal is going to climb up this wall. The cell's off as the animal climbs up this wall, but then it turns around up there on the top. So it's facing this way again, the cell's on, and it will stay on as the animal goes down, climbs down this wall back to the floor. Okay, well, they're not on there because the animal never really turns its head. If you look at the 90 degree position, so here's the cell firing in this same cell. Now the animal's going to go up and down this one. The cell is off whether the animal goes up or down. And the same thing for the, I didn't show the 270 position, but if I showed the 270 position over there too, it's also off going up or down. Meaning, if this is the on direction of the cell remains off as the animal goes up and down this wall and up and down this wall. Okay, and you could sort of, one way to look at this is, again, if this is the on direction here over at 0 degrees, as the animal pitches its head up to 90, or pitches its head down to 90, the cell will remain on, okay? But presumably it's off in these directions. Now from a math...
This cell basically ignores this degree of...
Pretty much, yep, yep. Yep. Now, from a mathematical point, if you were, so here's a tuning curve here, firing rate versus head direction. If you were to put this in polar coordinates, so here's this blue circle here is the tuning curve in polar coordinates for this horizontal plane. And these green ones here I've drawn in for what the cell would do in polar coordinates during these other planes. Okay? And what you've got here, if you were to connect them up, I haven't done that, but you would sort of have like a hemi-torus, sort of like a half a bagel, basically, where the other half over here is basically cut off. And the cell's firing rate is basically represented by the surface of the hemitorus, or the surface of the bagel.
Yeah, the bagel is not really explored.
Well, that's right, because the animal hasn't turned its head over. Okay, but that's the next experiment. Okay. All right. So what happens? This basically says what happens when the animal, turns its head upside down here. So we have this little apparatus where we start the animal out here and there's a partition. And the object is that the animal has to climb up the wall across the ceiling like that and then down this side in order to get a goal over here. Okay, this is about 4 feet, so there's, you know, not 4 feet. The animals.
It's like in a climbing wall position. It's a climbing wall
position. Like the climbing wall?
In the gym.
In the gym? Yeah, okay. So, what happens here?
The cave.
Yeah.
Oh, up here? Well, we already, so what happened? So we know what's going to happen on this wall and what's going to happen on this wall. It's pretty much just as I told you before. If this is the, if to the left here is the on direction of the cell, then the cell will fire as the animal comes up here, but not when it goes down. And it will fire when the animal's going down here, but not when it's going up. Okay, so that is just like before. What surprised us was when the animal was on the ceiling, okay, I mean, question is, which way would the cell fire? Two-thirds of the cells, two-thirds of the time, or it may even have been three-quarters, we haven't written this up yet, the cell lost its directional tuning. I don't know why. I mean, these are well-trained animals, and I should mention, it takes about 2 months to train an animal to just walk 4 feet upside down across the top there. Probably, well, probably not our rats, although I've been in places in the world where rats do climb across the ceilings. But I've stayed at a few hotels where I've seen rats go across the ceilings. But, I mean, so here, you know, the black is on the floor, the red is on the wall, cell's nicely directionally tuned, but when the animal went across the ceiling, it was flat, and this doesn't matter what which this is incorporating both directions. Well, in like I said, 2/3 to 3/4 of the time, the cells lost the directional tuning.
The other third,
they generally, what happened was that they usually took the reference. Let's see, if this is the direction the cell's firing, it would continue to fire when it went up the wall. And then when it went across the ceiling, it generally turned off, going this way, but turned on when it went that way. So it was using, as if it was using the room as a reference frame.
Is this something funky going on with the otolith logging? Does the otolith, the other thing, the broken symmetry that you have to have a net component down, and if you're upside down, then it's not making contact with nerve cells? And so there's some, what's the structure of the otolith?
What's the structure? The otoliths have cells like this, but in the otolith.
But if they're not, they're not on the top of the otolith, then you walk all the information. I mean, something has to be breaking. How do you know you're upside down? I mean, if the otolith didn't have hair cells on its top, then you wouldn't know you're upside down.
Well, there are two otolith organs. In one of them, the hair cells are located like on a floor, okay? So their hair cells are sticking up like this. So when you turn your head like over like that, they're going to be pulled down because of gravity. If they're upside down, it's probably a pretty similar stimulation to them. If you're on the floor versus upside down, you're going to be pretty similar. But then there's also the other otolith organ has its hair cells on the wall, so they're sticking out like that. So they're being tonically pulled this way, all right? But if you're upside down, of course, they're going to be tonically pulled the other way, you know? So the otolith organs are certainly tracking the animal's position with respect to gravity, are certainly capable. I mean, that information is certainly there. I mean, you turn your head upside down, your otolith organs certainly know. Now, the other thing is that people that work a lot with spatial orientation with NASA and with humans, I mean, they will tell you that humans, there's a lot of good evidence to show you that you often determine what is up versus down based on what you call the polarity of objects. So you know from a lifetime of experience that feet are down and heads are up. And you will partially determine your up and down just based on your visual cues, independent of what the otolith organs are telling you. And I mean, I can go over some of that evidence, but... Oh, really? Yeah. Well, they often have what they call visual reorientation illusions when they're up in zero G. They were, you know, they can be working at a rack of equipment here, and they look down at their colleague who slipped upside down. Okay, and they immediately like an Ecker cue. They immediately think that they're flipped upside down, and that their other colleague is right side up, because there's such a strong association that feet are down and heads are up. And that's called the visual reorientation illusion. And they often flip back and forth between the two orientations. And it's very what? Like with magnets? Tapping? Well, I haven't heard that before, but I'm sure that would help. I mean, certainly, cues, getting your bottom of your feet simulated would certainly help. In terms of being able to tell you what's up and down, the otolith organs can provide some information, but certainly in humans there's a lot that's dictated by just the visual perception of the objects around you. Anyways, this was a surprising result. We didn't expect the cells to lose their directional tuning when upside down on the ceiling. Two-thirds. Two-thirds.
Stick where the rate is away from zero, so it's like they're getting input at every orientation.
So the background firing rate went up. Yeah. So, and I mean, we didn't run the animals through a behavioral experiment, so I can't ask. You might ask the question. Okay, so here, this would indicate that the animal's head direction cells aren't firing in a directional manner. Is the animal disoriented? I don't know. I mean, we haven't tested the animal.
Well, but it made it around the cage. It didn't like go upside down.
That's right. But you're right. It knew where to walk, certainly. But.
And the other third did what you expected in a naive way? The other one third?
Yeah. That sort of used the room as a reference frame. So if that's the on direction, that was the on direction when the animal was walking this way on the ceiling. But when the animal is walking this way on the ceiling, it was off. So if it's on as it goes up the wall, and then immediately when it hits the ceiling and starts going this way, it turned off.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't try it in the dark. Yeah.
So I mean there wasn't any conflictory information. It's just a lack of. Two-thirds of the information dropped out, but what remains was consistent.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah. And I mean, and it wasn't like, I should mention, I mean, we found, I mean...
Huh? Not really fully consistent.
Why? Because it's on, off. What?
Off. Yeah.
No, but if you're using visual clues, it would be...
Right. So there isn't...
I mean, the ones that remained on were found in all the animals, and ones that went off were also found in all animals. So it wasn't like only one animal had all the on cells. This was again something that we were not expecting.
What do you do with this? What is this trying to tell you about the circuit?
I mean, in terms of the circuit, I don't know. What does it tell you about the circuit? That's a good question. I mean, that's okay. I mean, it's certainly not responding the way we had predicted it would. And it almost suggests that otolith signals have some sort of importance. in the circuit that haven't been included in any way. You may have been in the room when I was trying to rewind the video, but there was some portion in the video where we were testing the animals in a cage in zero G. And it turned out, we flew them aboard the NASA's airplane, the Vomit Comet. Yeah. So if you fly them in parabolic flight, you get about 20, 25 seconds of zero G. And they shut off. But no, they stayed on when the animal was on the floor. They were just fine when the animal was on the floor. But when the animal was on the ceiling, upside down, zero G, they were just like this. They lost the directional tuning, and they had an elevate, and they had an elevated baseline. What? When they were on the ceiling in zero G, like more than 90% of the time, they lost their directional tuning. I would say just about 100% of the time. So they would just had these flat lines. Well, yeah. So we actually, that's right. In 1G, 1/3 of the cells have directional tuning on the ceiling. No, yeah. We actually did the zero G experiments first, then we had to go back, and then we went back to look.
On the floor, they're fine the whole time.
Yeah.
So how do they know up and down? And
yeah. there might have been some visual cues for them to know. I mean, and we also tried going upside down ourselves in zero G. So the rats were looking at us upside down. We're trying to get the rat. So when the rat's on the floor and we're upside down, we're trying to get the rat to think it might be on the ceiling. But that didn't work. I mean, they were always fine when the rat was on the floor in the cage.
So you were doing the experiment?
Yeah.
So that's something. How many times did you get to? How many
times? We did 2 weeks worth, separated by, each week was separated by about a year and a half. The first time we flew, well, each time we flew four times. So we flew, yeah. I got violently ill the first couple of times I flew.
And each flight, or the 20 seconds?
Each flight you do 40 of these. So you get 40 episodes. of in each episode you get about 20-25 seconds of zero G, and then you get about 25 seconds of 2G. That's right. And the 2G was just as hard on your stomach as the zero G was. Yeah, because I mean it's There's
International Space Station. That's next, right?
Well, we had actually proposed to do this on the Neuralab, but Bruce got his grant, and they didn't want to. I mean, we were going to do head direction cells. Bruce did place cells, but there's yeah, maybe I don't know. Yeah. So I mean, we had applied, but we didn't get the grant, so we didn't go. So we did the next best thing, which was fly these parabolic flights. In terms of spatial orientation, to just say something about how strong visual cues can be to help determine what's up and down. Ian Howard. These guys may have known Ian, the ones who left, because don't they do visual cortex stuff? Ian Howard up in York in Canada has a tumbling room. Okay, so it's a small square room. It's probably about 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet that can be rotated, the whole room. Okay, and inside the room, he has a door and a table. They're all glued to the surface. Okay. It's a very polarizing environment, so you know what's up and down, right? What they do is they lay the subject supine, okay? and then they tilt the room so that you can imagine the subject laying on the table, and they rotate this room so that the floor is now that wall. Okay? And under those conditions, the subjects feel like that's really the floor. And they feel like, and if you ask them to pick their hands up like this, they feel like they're levitating. Because there's such a strong, the visual scene is so strongly compelling that down is this. Even though they should know, even though their back might be on the table, that, you know, in the otolith organs would be telling them that down is really this way. So it's just, again, an example of where the visual scene could be so strongly determining. So anyways, let me wrap this up. It's getting late. This is actually just a summary. Do you want a summary? So head direction cells are multimodal. We've seen both sensory and motor information. They're observed in several brain areas, mostly within the limbic system. The one exception was the striatum, really. The vestibular system appears critical for generating the signal, but motor signals are important for updating it, particularly when you're going into novel environments. And that the brainstem circuitry involving the dorsal tegmental nucleus and the nucleus prepositus might be important for integrating a vestibular signal for direction hailing. And then finally, the anterior thalamus seems to be sort of a convergent point for where landmark and idiothetic information seems to be converging. And lest I forget all the people who helped me do all these experiments. Jeff Calton here, postdoc, did the upside down experiments. Paul Duchenko helped me do some of the place cell experiments. Bob Stackman did a lot of the vestibular lesion experiments and also the rats locomoting in the novel environment. Joshua Bassett did a lot of the dorsal tegmental recordings with the angular head velocity cells. And Jeremy Goodrich and Ed Golub did a lot of the lesion experiments where we were lesioning some of these different nuclei. So that's it. Let's see. Oh, you don't want any more. You're tired.
So is anything come out of NASA's involvement in neuroscience except for the total boondoggle?
NASA's
in space is a far cry away from having an astronaut. Means it's just a sham so they can say that they should have some science in it. And maybe you weren't some good science using that money.
I'm the NASA stuff was, I'm part of a program project. I think the NASA stuff I was doing was part of a program project where I think the end result was to try to develop countermeasures to alleviate a lot of the symptoms of disorientation that the astronauts experience. I mean, just to give you a little idea, if you push a button to the right here, okay, and you flip yourself upside down and you flip it to the right, you're going to be pushing it the other way. To the right is this way here, but if I'm upside down and I go to the right, it's going to be that way, just the opposite. So astronauts get very confused. And in fact, there was some suggestion that the accident on the, was it what? No, on the Russian Soyuz, or not Soyuz, the Mir. When the Mir had that accident up there with the fire, that there was, because of, well, the collision. There was some suggestion that the collision may have happened because one of the astronauts had flipped the switch the wrong way. And again, if
doesn't that happen all the time in military pilots normally? Either they're going to free fall or going to collision.
I don't know. I mean, the frequency at which they do it, but I mention this just in the sense that I guess of the importance of trying to understand orientation here on the ground as well as up in space, so that you can avoid these types of problems. that's the problem of being disoriented and flipping it. And there's also, you know, the motion sickness problems that you have to worry about. And it gets wrapped up a lot with eye movements too, and being able to move your eyes in the right way to keep, you know, things on focus on your retina, which you obviously want to have happen when you're landing the shuttle back on the ground. And you don't want it to be a blur or anything like that. You know, there's also, there's I forget the name of it, but there's the problem that pilots experience when they take off from aircraft carriers.
The blanking?
Not so much the blanking, but the high G force that they go through. So normally the G vector is down, okay? But if you're accelerating very fast, like an off an aircraft carrier, you now have a pretty good strong G vector, you know, pushing you. This way.
Back.
Back. Sorry.
Yeah. Back and down.
That's right. Back. So. So they think that they're pitched up. That's right. Exactly. Yes. So they think that. So that the combination of the G vector going down because of gravity and the G vector going back, they think that they're actually like this. So they think they're going up at a much higher rate as they take off. That's right. Yeah. Were you a pilot? Yeah.
No, but you know that from physics. If you're an accelerating frame.
Right.
You fool yourself. You need to look at artificial at instruments.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But I mean, it's a constant struggle with telling the pilots to not fly by the seat of your pants and what you feel like, because if you flew what you feel like, that's why they wind up steering the plane down. That.
I don't fly. I thought you have to fly by instruments. People get killed. Right?
That's right.
When they lose, when they don't know how to do instruments.
Yeah. So I think there's been a lot of stuff done with two adaptation. I mean, the NASA program was largely there's this organization called the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, whereby their charge is to try to develop countermeasures for a whole host of sort of life science problems that would be encountered by having sending, you know, men or women to Mars and back in a probably like a 3-year mission. And the idea was that this might. There's a whole host of bone loss, muscle atrophy problems, cardiovascular problems, radiation problems, and they need to all be worked out before you can send someone up there and back. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, have you ever been spun in Jim Lackner's? He's got this big rotating room. Have you been spun in that?
Yeah.
But I mean, that was another good example where, again, the G-force, is back, and I just found my eyes always looking up, because you think you're looking down like that, so you naturally tend to look up. So, sure.